to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center, and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Happy to welcome Rebecca here today. Rebecca Bird is a professor at Stanford in anthropology, and she's done extensive and fascinating work, particularly in the areas of cooperation and understanding a lot of human behavior through the lens of signaling, of trying to understand what it is about particular behaviors and the costs that underlie them that help give them greater reliability as indicators of status, of ways of indicating intents for cooperation, et cetera. So welcome to Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. Okay, so I'm just gonna dive right in here. I'm going to start by talking about cooperation and various models for thinking about the maintenance of cooperation, and then I'm gonna move on to talking about signaling. So I think a central issue of human social life is what maintains cooperation, especially when there are conflicts of interest between individuals. Now, there have been various theories of cooperation that have been proposed that all generally arguing that cooperation is conditional, that it's provided conditional upon receiving some immediate or some short delayed material transaction. Cooperation is maintained by mutualism when individuals gain an immediate benefit that's greater than what they would have achieved in solitary pursuit. Cooperation is maintained by reciprocity when cooperative acts that are costly in the short term are repaid by the beneficiary of the act. Cooperation is maintained by indirect reciprocity when cooperators preferentially direct acts costly in the short term to those with a reputation for cooperating, regardless if they've helped you in the past, and eventually it all comes out in the wash. Now, many tend to treat the problem of what maintains cooperation as though populations were homogeneous, cooperative tasks were all alike, and all individuals face the same constraints and opportunities. But I think that we need to really pay attention to heterogeneity between individuals, and it's particularly relevant for understanding why individuals might engage in cooperative economic pursuits. And here I'm particularly interested in cooperative hunting. Mutualism is the most common model of the benefits of cooperative hunting production. Hunting, foraging, I'm kind of using the term interchangeably here. By working together and pooling the profits, cooperative hunters are hypothesized to gain higher rates of income than they could have achieved working alone. And this has been demonstrated in many cases, like in llama laran whale hunters and so on. But this can work only if all cooperators are equal when it comes to their productive ability, or if the pooling that ensues is biased so that those who work harder gain a reward in proportion to their effort. In order for mutualism to sustain cooperation, hunters must positively assort according to skill, such that better hunters pair up with other good hunters. Or if they don't, those who produce more get to keep more. If not, cooperation entails a free rider dilemma. Why should a better hunter cooperate at all if they can't rely on reaping any benefits? The cooperation is in terms of the immediate hunting act. Not that we're talking about cooperation in doing the same activity, not cooperation in doing different activities and sharing as a result. So yes, I'm not talking about division of labor. So with this question in mind, I looked at cooperative hunting among Mardu, who are Aboriginal foragers in the Western Desert of Australia, with the goal of investigating to what extent mutualism maintains cooperation in different types of foraging activities. Now, Mardu are speakers of several different language groups, primarily Gardajara and Manjeljara, living in the great and little sandy deserts of Western Australia. Manjeljara speaking Mardu were among the last Aboriginal people in Australia to live as full-time hunter-gatherers. And the Manjeljara family who adopted me as their daughter was first contacted in 1964, and they went into Balfour Downs Pastoral Station and then along to Jigalong Mission in 1966. The Mardu who came into the missions in the 1960s didn't take happily to mission life, and as soon as the political climate shifted from one of formal assimilation to self-determination, in the 1980s, they were able to move back to their desert homelands and establish three communities, Punmu, Barngur, and Kunawarji. And we work mainly from Barngur, which has a nomadic residential population of about 100 to 150 individuals, depending on the time of day, and the week, and the year. Although many of the Mardu we work with were born as nomadic foragers, foraging has definitely changed some in the last 40 years. Mardu now tend to reside in one place for longer periods of time, and they receive social welfare payments of approximately $500 per month. They have a small store in the community where they can purchase food, but this doesn't go very far, as one packet of ramen is $4. So Mardu have increased their foraging mobility over the years, and more have acquired motor vehicles. And now most people forage by choosing a general region to visit within about 50 kilometers one-way distance from the community. These are people piling into my car. They then go and establish a temporary central place, what everybody calls a dinnertime camp. And travel to the camp is by vehicle, but once there, foragers fan out on foot to various locations. And they return anywhere from 2 to 5 hours later with their harvest to the dinner camp, where they cook it at the dinner camp. There's a typical harvest. Those are large monitor lizards. And then they share it out among members of the foraging party, consume most of it, and then return in the late evening to the community. Now, on an average day, about 3 out of the 12 families, or 30% of the families in the community, go out in hunting parties, and these hunting parties bring in a total of about 8 kilograms of bush meat. That's just counts the meat, not the fruit or any other resources, per day, which works out to an average consumption of about 1,000 calories per person per day, which is quite substantial. So they're pretty much part-time foragers still. And this is what a typical fridge looks like in the community. That's an emu leg and a bag of meat that's been cut off the bone, and then my apples and onions. So the data that I'm going to report on here, we collected over 236 dinnertime camp days that are spread out over 32 months of field work between 2000 and 2009. And those dots represent just some of the foraging camps that we've been on. The community that we're in there is Barngur, is right in the middle of all of those dots. Now, we collect most of our data by going out with foraging parties from Barngur and then following at least one individual on foot as they hunt out from camp. And a trip out and back from camp is what we call a bout, a foraging bout. And those foraging bouts average about 3 hours in length. About 80% of what people consume on dinner camps comes from hunted or collected foods. This is a picnic basket on a multi-day camp, showing a typical mix of bush and store foods that people are getting while they're out on dinner camps. Those are witchetty grubs in the bark tray, and then there's two legs of kangaroo, and then some damper off to the side. Bread is... Of the bush foods in the diet on dinner camps, 85% comes from small and large animals, with the remainder from plant foods, insects, and honey. So all the plant foods are in green, the insects are in blue, and then all the animals are in various shades of rust color. By far the two most significant resources consumed at dinner camps are bustard at 30% of the calories and sand goanna at 38%. And the kangaroos, the larger kangaroos, make up only about 9% of all the calories acquired. So what I'm going to focus on in this talk is cooperation in guano hunting, because it's the single most significant source of resource of food income in the, on the bush diet. About 35% of all foraging bouts are cooperative. So they don't cooperate a lot, but most of the cooperation comes in the form of guano hunting. In the interest of brevity, I don't have time to describe all the cooperation, all the different kinds of foraging activities. I'm going to focus just on this hunting for sand monitors, the guanas, the smaller lizards, which accounts for about half of all the foraging bouts that we have recorded. Sand monitor hunting is mostly conducted by women, and there are several different ways that individuals cooperate. In the winter season, which is the film you're seeing here, hunts occurring in the winter, successful hunting involves targeting patches of old-growth spinifex grass for burning. Two or more individuals burn the same patch and share search costs for the prey revealed in the patch. When they hunt, each hunter separates by about 100 meters. They'll call each other over to assist in pursuit and capture if they find a fresh tracks or a likely burrow. They coordinate in probing around the burrow, in concentric circles, with the point of their digging sticks to locate the den. And then one might dig up the entrance hole to determine the direction of the tunnel. Another probes the terminal chamber. Depending on the depth of the den, the hunters may take turns in the excavation. And in the summer season, they don't burn. They have to track the guano, so that cooperating and tracking is very important. During a cooperative hunt, most partners pool their harvest, and usually there's just two hunters cooperating. One hunter, usually the older or the more skilled hunter, will transport all the prey, and she'll take responsibility for cooking their pooled returns at the dinner camp. And when she removes the individual guano from the fire, she initially divides the harvest evenly between the partners she cooperated with while hunting. Each individual hunter then distributes her own portions to others in the dinnertime camp. She distributes them to her family, her children, her spouse, her brothers, her sisters, anyone who's on the dinnertime camp, others with whom she didn't hunt. So that's the secondary distribution. So we have primary distributions where the hunter, the cooperating hunters are splitting up the catch among themselves, and then secondary distributions where the hunters take their catch and then distribute it further to non-cooperators. So on cooperative hunts, there are two ways a hunter might bias the amount she keeps for herself. She might give less or more to her hunting party in the primary, her hunting partner in the primary distribution, and she might keep a portion for herself that's smaller or larger than the individual portions she gives away to others in the secondary distribution. Okay, so first, we explored the effects of cooperation on mean return rates across foraging activities. So this is kcals acquired, edible kcals acquired per hour relative to whether or not you were engaged in cooperative hunting or solitary hunting. If cooperation is maintained through mutualism, we expected per capita returns to be higher for cooperative hunts than for solitary hunts. But particularly for guano was the only sig. We had two of these. None of these were significant. So honey, nectar, fruit, no significant differences in cooperation, non-cooperation. There were also no significant differences. You can see for the larger prey items, kangaroo, bustard, and cat on the left, solitary hunting returns were very high compared to cooperative hunting returns, but there's also a great deal of variance around those means, and so those were not significant. The two significant differences were between the monitored lizard hunting, the parenti, which are the bigger monitored lizards, and the guana, which were the smaller monitored lizards. Parenti was the only one that showed significant increases in returns, per capita returns, with cooperative hunting. Guana showed, even though that difference is small, our sample size was so large that guana showed a significant increase, a significant decrease in cooperative returns over solitary returns. And in fact, the difference was on the order of 100 calories per hour. So when you cooperate, on average, it reduced your returns from 545 to 441 calories per hour. Okay, so focusing in on the guano hunting because it's so common.
Are those quantities total quantities or per capita?
Per capita.
So they're actually acquiring more, it's just that they have to share it. So the hunting is more efficient in that sense.
It's what, the solitary hunting? No, this is per capita hunting returns prior to distribution.
Right, and so if you didn't divide it by two or whatever, they're actually getting higher returns in kilograms.
The group as a whole.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so the negative return in goanna hunting cooperative hunts could be made up in the secondary distributions if those who cooperated were more likely to be able to keep more for themselves after the secondary distributions. So then what we looked at was their consumption returns, how much they kept relative to how much time they spent hunting. And there were no, even though cooperative hunters got slightly higher grams per hour net consumption, the differences were not significant. Now, then I thought that, well, maybe the reason that we're not seeing a significant effect of cooperation is because we're averaging across heterogeneous individuals with different constraints and trade-offs. So one of the first and one of the most obvious sources of heterogeneity is gender. Men and women have different constraints, different trade-offs. So there were really interesting differences between men and women in how their returns, per capita returns, responded to increases in group size. So women are in the open circles, men are in the closed circles. Men saw no significant change in their per capita returns with group size. Women saw significant decreases in their per capita returns with group size. Now, we would expect then, if women saw significant decreases in their returns with group size, that they'd be less likely to cooperate than men would. But actually, we found was the opposite pattern, that the odds that a female goanna hunter will cooperate in a hunt are 2.6 times greater than the odds that male hunters will cooperate. So women's probability of cooperation in sand monitor hunting is 68%. Men's is 44%. So women cooperate much more often than men do, despite the fact that they get lower returns than men do when they cooperate.
Do they have a realistic view of that, or do they have a belief that more people are more successful?
No, I'm going to describe what they think about cooperation stuff a little bit later. Yeah. So then we looked at another source of heterogeneity. We looked at differences in the effects of hunting skill or effort, because Mardu identify good hunters and poorer hunters, and they have a word to describe the good hunters and poorer hunters, and they generally know which hunters are in the top half of the distribution, which hunters are in the middle part of the distribution, and which hunters are in the lower end of the distribution in terms of their hunting ability. Now, this ability incorporates not just skill, but also hard work and effort. So what I did was to classify skill by ranking each hunter according to their mean average return rate when hunting alone. And I used this rank to predict the relative difference in return rates between cooperative and solitary hunting. So on the y-axis you have relative returns, cooperative hunting minus solitary hunting. So a positive difference indicates individuals gain better rates when cooperating. A negative difference means they do worse when cooperating. And what we found was there was a really strong relationship between hunt rank and your difference score, that only the more productive hunters did worse when cooperating. And each unit increase in rank resulted in an average 23 calories per hour increase in one's relative distribution return rate, or sorry, acquisition return rate when cooperating. Right? And it was about after rank 22 or so when hunters started to exceed, consistently exceed, have positive relative difference returns. So, better hunters are doing worse when they cooperate, poorer hunters are doing better when they cooperate. So, if that's the case, we might expect better hunters to cooperate less often than poorer hunters. But surprisingly, there was no effect of rank on the percentage of hunts that are cooperative, that they engaged in that were cooperative. There was a significant effect of gender.
Was any of this teaching?
Yeah, that's a good question. And no, generally it was older women hunting with other older women. We had a lot of intergenerational partnerships, but I was surprised to see how few of those were between really young women and older women. A lot of them were between a woman in a, one young postmenopausal woman and a really old postmenopausal woman. The young women and the old women, I think, are doing something different. Young women are staying home, and I have another graph to show that, but they're staying home and they're doing other activities. That, I think, is an actual division of labor, and it's the older women that are cooperating with each other. Okay, so they don't cooperate. Okay, so why do they cooperate so frequently? When they benefit neither through returns to scale, when they don't benefit through returns to scale. Another plausible hypothesis is that better hunters may be more likely to gain benefits after the secondary distributions. Either others are going to be more likely to give to them, or they're going to be able to keep more of their own production for themselves. Or alternatively, it could be that better hunters are using the act of cooperation, or they're benefiting from the act of cooperation as a form of communication, engaging in a display of altruism as a way to signal some underlying motivation, perhaps toward public goods provisioning. But in order to properly test a signaling argument, we first need to understand the signaling context so that we can properly identify what information is being communicated. Among Mardu, the road to influence, renown, and power of some sort is through generosity. There is shame in forceful command. There is shame in the accumulation of wealth, in refusals to share, and in overt assertiveness. The social distinctions that arise among Mardu are not ones of material possession, where individuals are marked by what they can own or what they can claim, but of dispossession. When Mardu talk about hunting, they often describe their underlying motivation as hunting to share, not hunting to eat. And one who produces more and shares more of that production with others is called Mertilia. And Mardu say, when a Mertilia goes out hunting, she has a good feeling that she's going to get so much and be able to feed others. Good hunters always think that when they go out, and it helps them to hunt better. When a really good hunter goes out, she gives so much away and takes home only a small piece for herself, but she will always walk away feeling bukarpa. Mertilia refers to a skillful hunter who consistently acquires and shares production, particularly in the context of providing food, not only for your own family, but for those with whom she has little obligation to share. This was how the term was defined to me. So a Mertilia is a person who not only frequently gives, but a person who frequently has things to give, a person who works harder than others so that surplus production can be distributed to all. Now, implicit within this definition of Mertilia is that it is other-regarding, one doesn't share for gain, but because one genuinely cares about feeding others. But Mardu do believe that Mertilia gain benefits from their effort. And it's Bukorpa, which is what many Mardu see as the reward for Mertilia. Bukorpa means generally warmth and happiness, but its English translation is not, we don't really have a word to describe it. It's the happiness that's the product of generosity that binds people together in a family group. Without generosity, you feel you're not in a family, Mardu say. You're just for yourself, you're not for everybody, you don't share things. People, especially good hunters, cooperate when hunting in order to demonstrate their commitment to building family and contributing to the public good. So again, Marty say, I like to hunt with someone who's going to share. If we hunt together, I'll give you half of what I get. Then you have something to share, even if you didn't get lucky yourself. You're looking out, you're kenyuninpa, looking out for someone else by cooperating. If a good hunter were to not cooperate, instead just go out solitarily hunting, Marty says she would be accused of being greedy, of not wanting to split her harvest with a partner. So if you exclude others from hunting with you, especially if you're a good hunter, it may mean you prevent them from acquiring and exclude them from gaining the benefits of being able to demonstrate their own generosity. So in a Mardu way, hunting cooperatively is one way to ensure that someone else has something to share.
So when you hunt alone, you're not expected to share, is that right?
No, you do still share, but you only share in that first distribution. So you share the same way to friends and family, but you don't have to split that harvest with your cooperating partner.
To what extent do they also talk about, for instance, you said they go out for 3 to 5 hours, that there's a social component, that it is more enjoyable to be out?
No, they're not very social when they're hunting. And you get in trouble if you talk to them. They're very, very focused on the signs, because it's a tricky skill-based activity. Really focused on the signs and the thinking about the animal. And yeah, it's totally focused on hunting.
So you say they cook and they eat at the time when they do these cooperative hunts. They cook and eat the food during this hunt period.
At the dinner camp. So they'll go out, they'll establish their camp. They'll walk out from the camp. They'll acquire everything. They never eat out. They always consume back. So
are their family members with them when they're at the camp?
Camp populations are really quite variable. Some of the family members are with them. Some are not. Some are back at the community. They don't always take all their family members with them. But they conceive of the dinner camp as a household, a temporary household, right? You're expected to treat everyone at the dinner camp as if they were members of your same household.
Are they more likely to hunt with members, or family members, or relatives than people with less?
Yeah, everyone. One of the things I did do was look at whether good hunters or poorer hunters were more likely to hunt with household members they live with in the community or kin, and it turns out there was no effect. So everyone hunts with kin and household members, but good hunters were not more likely to do so than poorer hunters. Okay, so what my gloss on what Marty say about this is that the Myrdalia's generosity binds groups together, because in being generous, Myrdalia signals honestly that she has no interest in pecuniary gain from her skill. Signaling one's disinterest in pecuniary gain and conversely one's interest in provisioning public goods is a real powerful way to earn respect from others. Costly signaling might structure the benefits that Myrdalia achieve through cooperation if individuals differ in their levels of generosity, if generosity is difficult to observe and there's the potential for dishonesty through cheap talk, if others gain from knowing who's genuinely motivated by public goods provisioning, and if better hunters have lower costs or gain greater benefits from displaying their public-mindedness to others. So the prediction that I was able to test relative to this is that better hunters should share a greater proportion of their catch and receive no more from others than poorer hunters. If the benefits of hunting are gained through mutualism, we'd expect better hunters to share proportionately less than poorer hunters to make up for their losses in pooling. So how does it all work out? Well, it turns out you can see the first set of bar graphs shows you the amount acquired by high-ranked individuals, middle-ranked individuals, and low-ranked individuals, and that there are strong and consistent differences in how much they produce on average per hunting trip. But there are no differences in how much they receive from others, nor differences in their total net consumption, once you add in how much they receive from others, how much they kept for themselves. That one little low bit on the low ranked, it's right on the edge, but it's not significant. But there were supporting the signaling hypothesis, there were really strong differences in the percentage of the harvest that was given away. So high-ranked hunters gave out 35% of their income, middle-ranked hunters gave out only 29% of their income, and low-ranked hunters only 18% of their income. So I think that there's two stories here. There's a simple story about mutualism and the importance of looking at heterogeneity. And by paying attention to heterogeneity among individual foragers, we're able to see that only the poorer hunters benefit through mutualistic cooperation. Better hunters also cooperate with others, and they don't discriminate against their partners according to relative ability, and they don't keep more for themselves because they acquired more. So they tend to do worse when cooperating. So better hunters pay two types of cost to signal their generosity. The first cost is in cooperating, because you lose out through pooling if you're a better hunter. And the second cost is in distributing, because you give out too much. So what this suggests more broadly, I think, if you think about the broad implications of this, is that costly signaling might be an important stabilizing agent in cooperation when heterogeneity threatens to let some individuals benefit at the expense of others. But there's a more complicated story here, too, in the reason behind why Marty signal in this way and what they gain by doing so. And I think that in order to understand why the better hunters share and cooperate so much, we have to know about the way this articulates with the fundamental foundation of Mardu political structure, which is social and material egalitarianism. I think that better hunters share more to signal a commitment to material equality, but they cooperate in order to signal their commitment to social equality. And that better hunters cooperate as a way to diffuse the sharpness of the inequalities they create through sharing too much. So it goes like this. This was not easy to think up. It's very tricky. Okay. Most women hunt, and they're successful acquirers every day. And in the distributions of meat that follow, every woman has the chance to give and receive, but not to the same amount. Inequalities in acquiring are eliminated daily by inequalities in giving. So those who acquire more share more. Those who acquire less receive more. But inequality arises in the long term because goanna are a fairly predictable resource, and that harvests are dependent to some extent on the time spent working and the skill of the acquirer. And so the outcome of this predictability is that some consistently acquire and more than others, and then some consistently share more than others. So inequalities in social prestige that are gained through are gained through being a person who consistently gives more out. If a better hunter cooperates, especially with a poorer hunter, they'll immediately pool their harvest. This allows the poorer hunter a larger harvest than she might get otherwise. The pooling comes at a cost not to the better hunter's consumption, how much she eats. She eats just as much as everyone else, no matter what. But it comes at a cost to her ability to be generous with meat. If a better hunter can consistently expect to acquire about 6 individual goanna lizards, a poorer hunter about 3. If the better hunter cooperates with the poorer hunter, she can raise the poorer hunter's donation potential to 4.5 at a cost of 1.5 goanna to her own donation potential. So by cooperating with poorer hunters and taking on a cost to their social capital, better hunters make it possible for others to have the opportunity to give, which is an honest signal of their disinterest in the social inequality that they've generated. So they've demonstrated that they've moved beyond claiming social capital for themselves, and they're giving social capital to others. And I think that this honest signaling is a social commitment that engenders trust. It's a commitment to social equality as well as to material equality. And I think that these sorts of signals of pecuniary disinterest are a really important class of signals that are critical to understanding the maintenance of social equality. They contrast with signals that are competitive or that are designed to gain prestige through wasteful advertising or conspicuous consumption, signals of generosity. So, yeah. Hold on, my mouth is so dry.
Is there social understanding of vulnerability, life stage vulnerability, or
yes,
life state vulnerability, that
like younger people?
Yes, that feeds into this sense that if you're a good hunter, something could still happen to you, and you would be safe in the community if you became vulnerable.
Not that I've gotten from people. The sense that I get from people is that it's their responsibility to care for those that are less fortunate than themselves. That it's this whole notion of Kenyan and Pa, which also refers to how they hold and look after country. So they hold and look after people who are dependent on them the same way they hold and look after country. So they're always concerned about, oh, that old lady, she's pretty sick. I'll cooperate with her because I need to look out for her. I need to make sure I take care of her. Oh, and then these young people, they're not very good foragers. That white fellow woman, she doesn't know what she's doing. I better cooperate with her to make sure that she gets some meat too. So it's this notion of looking after others. It would be very, very bad form to think about oneself when you're engaged in this Kenyan and Pa activity. Not that people don't think about themselves, but this is not what people talk about when they talk about Kenyan and Pa.
I have a general question, but first just to clarify. So there are two qualities here. There's the observable quality of being a good hunter, and there's the unobservable quality of being generous. So can you distinguish between, can you observe separate equilibrium among good hunters, like good hunters that are generous and good hunters that are not generous?
When I asked Mardu about this, they said, there's no such thing as a good hunter who's not generous.
Okay.
And so, but there certainly are differences in generosity. You can see the differences in generosity. So they say that in order to be considered a Mardilia, you have to be both a good hunter and be generous. But I'm sure that there were people out there that were generous, I mean, that were good hunters, but were not as generous.
So do we observe like any good hunters that are not getting respect? Because if all good hunters are getting respect, how can we know that they're getting respect for being generous and not for being good hunters, right? So how can we know this causes even an explanation of being generous? And I guess this comes with a related question, a general question, regardless of this specific context. Mm-hmm. If the underlying quality that's being conveyed by the costly signal is inner motivation, how come the signal is not susceptible to mimicry? So if I'm a good hunter, and I know that I'll get prestige gains, still if I'm not generous, I can act as if I'm generous, right, and reap the prestige gains. So
you can't be a good hunter unless you are a good hunter.
Right, that's my point. So the good hunter quality is observable. Right, so you're saying everybody knows who's a good hunter.
It's observable through your production.
Okay.
But you could just not work very hard. Even though you intrinsically have the skill, you could just say, I'm going to go out and pretend that I'm a bad hunter and not work very hard, and then then I don't have to share so much.
So there are two different things here. Either the cost of signaling is about being a good hunter, or the cost of signaling is about being generous. Now, if the cost of signaling is about being generous, how come the, there has to be some quality dependency between the form of the signal and the message it conveys, right? Or am I getting something wrong here?
No, I'm not sure I follow you entirely, but I'm not really arguing that being a good hunter is a costly signal.
Right.
I'm arguing that the generosity on the part of better hunters is a costly signal.
Right. So, but if that would be the case, then we would need to observe that more generous hunters, regardless of being good hunters or not, more generous hunters get more respect, right? This would be the main prediction of the signaling.
This is the next step, is to try to figure out a way to measure that.
Okay.
And
in general, in theory, if the underlying quality is about inner motivation, how come it's not susceptible to mimicry? So how come I know, if I'm a good hunter,
Well, if you're...
If you're a good hunter and I'm a good hunter, and you're, like, generous and I'm not generous, I can act as if I'm generous and share the same thing and cooperate the same thing. So you won't be reaping any more prestige than I would, right?
So if you're a bad hunter, you'd
no,
be generous...
No, if I'm a good hunter, we're both good hunters.
We're both good hunters.
Quality. Just the unobservable quality. You're generous, I'm not generous, right? And I will act as if I'm generous, and you know, I will cooperate.
By acting as if you're generous, you are generous. I mean,
right,
no
okay, so what's the...
It's,
so what's,
why is it not observable to be generous?
Yeah.
I understand that it's not observable.
Exactly.
What it's distinguishing between is the action and the mentality behind the action.
But I guess some of it would...
Well, being good hunter.
So I think one question then is, how do you observe this in other situations? Because one thing is that if this is a daily thing and it's predictable, you're saying, okay, here's these cases where you're supposed to act in a particular way, and I think this may be hard to arrange as an observer, but what if some emergency comes up? Who can we trust in unexpected situations? And is that signal of interstate something where, here's something where you're doing it on a daily basis where in some ways it's not that costly, but you're showing you're generous and will take care of others, and now something comes up where it might be much more costly to you to take care of others, who can we predict would do that? Maybe one of the
issues. That's one of the things that that I've been thinking about is how to try to test that and how to try to look at perhaps the social networks of more generous people, better hunters. Who do you call on in the time of if you have some life event that you need someone to call on?
That's probably a point of news, but first of all, looking at these photographs, is it mainly older women who are from this
time? Yeah, so if you look at I have another graph for another talk where I look at the probability of engaging in these different foraging activities over the lifespan. And goanna hunting is predominantly older women.
Okay, so we're going to assume it's older women. Now there's other groups of the community that are not coming out in these hunts, and they're doing other things. That's what I meant by, the question wasn't well posed about the division of labor. So can these generous hunters come back and receive social recognition, be acknowledged in song, be not acknowledged in story, perhaps, I don't know what kind of mutual care they do, but get a massage or get help with a medical problem or have somebody run into town for them? I mean, are they reaping these?
This is a classic egalitarian society where any sort of social any sort of bragging or direct
No, I'm not saying they're bragging, but somebody's talking favorably about them or incorporating them in a story or a lesson.
There's some of that. There's more talk about people that are not generous than there is promoting people who are, because there's this real social norm associated with not praising those who are good. So it's all about denigrating those who don't conform, who don't live up to the potential, but they don't really go around like a good hunter will never openly acknowledge the fact that he or she was the one who acquired all of this largesse.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if in part it's the context, because in some of your other work or where we would logically go with this as behavioral ecologists is where status is sort of the proximate mechanism, so the ultimate would be some kind of fitness difference. And so that may be a way to distinguish this question some of your other work you've dealt with this. I mean, are the better hunters, where's the food going? Do their kids have better health and success and survival, or do they have more mating opportunities? And
I think that a lot of this cooperation is related to the fact that these guys are one of Sarah Hurdy's like cooperative breeding societies. These guys co-nurse, older women and younger women co-reside. Women reside with their mothers. Mothers are important caretakers, providing a lot of really highly intensive care. In the community, in the past, there was a lot of sororal polygyny. Moms would reside with their daughters, and then daughters would be married to the same husband. So you'd have a really strong core of related women in each of these groups. And women would always talk about the importance of cooperating with other women partially because they can't rely on their spouses. There's only one of them, and they're gone most of the time. So they'd always talk about the importance of this social network of other women. And so the older women and would talk about the fact that they would cooperate with younger women would take turns doing various activities. Older women would go out hunting. Younger women would stay back and take care of the kids, because you can't really take kids out on these hunting trips. And then they might switch positions, and older women would take care of the kids, or younger women might stay behind and collect firewood and collect fruits and seeds, which they can do with the children present. So that's what I think the benefit, at least in the past, in the mobile situation, the benefit of being a good hunter has to do with supporting these cooperative social networks of women.
And I guess where I felt a little frustrated, it may speak to some of the other people in the room, is that a lot of the animal literature on sharing and cooperation deals with, as in here, a cooperation in a task. Whereas, like, the economists have kind of looked at what humans do in terms of a division of labor. So the fact that you do, you know, something different, bring it to the table. So you may take a loss in terms of hunting, but you may be the recipient of some gain in some other part of the economic scheme, which is so complex in humans. And so, you know, I guess I feel like there's sometimes mutualism is, I guess I feel frustrated a little bit where we are in our own discipline in terms of how we sort of articulate what we know about the division of labor and sort of this bigger schema versus cooperation in a task, and how we kind of, I mean, humans are, I mean, you know, this is a group of hunters and gatherers, and it's still so complex to figure out what's going on, you know. Anyway, just how it is that you think about mutualism as it may extend, how might it change if we thought about the bigger economic system?
Well, I just wonder if this group has ever been in a situation where there was more than subsistence, in other words, where some accumulation or some surplus was possible, and if this effort can be sustained in that situation.
Here for, yeah. For Mardu?
Yeah.
There's almost no accumulation.
And they've never been. It's never been.
Never. I mean, you go into people's houses, there's nothing in houses. People don't take care of possessions. They sometimes have vehicles, which they'll have for a short period of time. But there's this real lack of attention to the material products of everyday life. And part of the reason, I think, is because they're still extremely mobile. They're just moving all the time, moving from community to community and from ritual business to ritual business throughout the whole Western Desert.
Why have you chosen this particular group of people to study this idea of mutualism?
I chose the people because they were interesting and foraging, and everything else has come out of trying to understand what's going on with the people. So it's not like I am interested in mutualism. It's not like I want to build better models of mutualism.
So this is like an anthropological survey for you? And this is
yes, this is very anthropological. I'm really interested in figuring out the logic behind what's going on in this society. Brian?
Hi, Rebecca. I was wondering if you could talk about So one of the problems, of course, that we have as ethnographers is that we're seeing the outcome of all of these behavioral processes that are working, and it's hard to understand necessarily how the outcome reflects different actors' preferences or motivations, because we have all these interacting motivations. For instance, when you observe a good hunter hunting in larger party sizes on average than a poor hunter, how do you disentangle whether that is a product of the good hunter deciding, I would like to hunt with another hunter? Or is it perhaps a case where you have poorer hunters gravitating towards these
mm-hmm.
bigger hunters?
Yeah.
And so it's very difficult, because as an ethnographer, of course, we observe the association of the good hunters with probably poorer hunters more often. And getting at that level of, okay, is this really an intentional outcome based on the strategies of the good hunter wanting to equalize?
Yeah.
Or is this, you know, a strategy of a poor hunter saying, well, if I hunt with this good hunter, I'm going to get more to take home with? And you could.
Yeah, I can see. I can
so
see. Actually,
do you
I can
ever
see. Yeah.
Make questions like,
oh,
about
yeah,
the preferences
yeah.
and
both,
how this maps on?
Both. I see people are conflicted sometimes, you know? Sometimes they get tired of being the generous person, and they just want to go out by themselves, get their big meat, and share it out, right? So there's tension, there's conflict. That's not to say that every person is perfectly generous all the time. And so sometimes I see, you know, in terms of the formation of, so everybody gets out of the car, and you have to be quick. You have to grab your digging stick really quick because the old ladies are off. They're off in four different directions. And I don't know how they decide who's going to go with who sometimes, but usually it's like two women will go off in the same direction, and those women will end up cooperating with each other. And they're all moving really fast so that none will have to take me along because I slow them down. So I end up going with my mom, who's supposed to be taking care of me, and so I go with her. But, you know, she'll say things to me like, oh, you know, I really should cooperate with that old lady. Like in this shot here, one of these old women was really, really sick. And so one of the best hunters, the one in the, I was going to say the one in the beanie, but they're all in beanies. The one there in the blue skirt said, you know, I better stay without that old lady because she's really sick and I better look after her. And the other hunters, like this Nancy there in the blue and red beanie and the blue striped shirt, she's one of those good hunters that tends to always run off and not let other people cooperate with her. So she scores fairly low on the percentage cooperation. There's a variability, definitely.
Did you have a chance to observe how they teach children to behave this way?
Children, they don't. There's no direct teaching of children. It's all pure observation. And the children are basically left, when children come out on these camps, they're in their own group. They do their own foraging. They have their own particular types of activities that they prefer. They go after these lizards that are on the rocks. And so they'll crawl all over these rocks looking for these smaller goant monitor lizards. And then when children get about 10 and 12, then they'll start going out on their own and looking for goanna. But they need to be taller so that they can walk farther because they have to walk quite a ways.
I was wondering also, like, just in terms of other things, like, are they told, you know, to share something with other, you know, is that something that's constantly?
Oh, yeah, from the moment they're born, they are told to share everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Are there any other sources of income or anything else comes from this community? Do they get government subsidies?
No, government subsidies is it. There's really no other jobs. There's what they call CDEP, which comes in and out, and it's basically work for the dole, which mm-hmm. takes people, basically you get your dole money, but you have to spend, you know, 5 hours a day picking up trash, which people hate. They'd much rather go out hunting. The government refuses.
Do they share the money? Or what?
Oh, yeah, the money is just like everything else. It flows like water, and they usually gamble it.
Going back to the Chilean, is there a difference that you were able to observe in what they, when they tell them to share, between what they say to boys or to girls, and how they're?
No, they are. I was really struck by how gender egalitarian they are. They refuse to even admit that girls and boys have different skills,
but then
and
at
abilities.
Some point, the hunting splits up.
After initiation. Because the boys go through formal initiation when they're about 14, 15. After initiation, then they're considered men, and they hang out more with the men. And then they won't start hunting kangaroo or use a rifle now until they're at least in their mid-20s, because the older men don't feel they have enough responsibility. So they'll still pretty much hunt lizards, goanna lizards, and stuff with the younger kids until they're about 20.
Did you have the opportunity to observe this in different places and on different tasks? I mean, they're wearing clothes, so the clothes get washed. Does each person wash their own clothes, or do they cooperatively wash clothes?
No, everybody washes their own clothes, even kids.
So this sense of cooperation and generosity and the signaling really occurs mostly with the hunting?
No, it also occurs with ritual business, which I know a lot less about because most of it I'm not supposed to know. But people also, the only thing that Mardu actually do accumulate is knowledge. And they will share knowledge the same way that they share resources. They view that the accumulation of knowledge, the only purpose of the accumulation of knowledge is to be able to give it away to others. So men accumulate sacred boards, and they'll get a store of sacred boards, but it's not just, you don't win the competition by getting more sacred boards than anyone else. You then win by bringing up young men, and they become your proteges, and you impart your sacred information to them, and you give out your sacred boards. So the more men, young men you have that you can give out your sacred boards to, that's how you gain status within the ritual arena. And some people have suggested that the ritual arena and the foraging arena are linked. And Marty say that it's the same for men and women, is that by demonstrating your generosity in the sort of economic arena, you are more likely to be trusted with the ritual information and rise in the ritual hierarchy. And it would be the same for both men and women. Yeah.
Given the total pool of individuals in your high, medium, and low rank production, is there any difference in frequency and participation in the dinner table camps away from the settlement?
There's a lot, but the problem is that I don't know how much of that is due. I don't know if they really hunt less or if they just hunt less with me because they don't want to go out with me. So there's definitely my ability to get a broad range of people in the community is limited by my kinship connections. So the people that are, there's two groups in the community, one that is Mandaljara and one that is Gardajara, and the Gardajara do not talk to the Mandaljara. They hate the Mandaljara and vice versa. So I'm not able to interact much with the other language speakers. There's a lot of tension there between the two. So there's a bunch of people in the community that I don't know a whole lot about. And some of those are in my poor hunter category.
About how outsiders are sort of factored into this network of cooperators, you know, and whether or not you would ever, how is this, do you have a sense that this reputation for generosity is really constrained within like a pretty definable in-group, or do you think this is something that is directed more generally to the entire community, or is there any way that you could test those ideas about who they're signaling to? Why?
I don't know. They don't speak of themselves in terms. I mean, when they talk about themselves, it's always in terms of all Mandaljara, and their identity is formed mainly around their dialect group, what dialect group they are. But Mandaljara as a dialect group is scattered all over this huge area. So I think when they think of themselves, they think of their social network, they think of all their relatives, distant kin, affinal kin, in other communities as well, like Punu, Kunawarji, and so on. And they might think, they might not include William's family and Gardajara people that are living right in the community. But I don't know, I'm kind of guessing there because I haven't really explored that thing. What did I say? 32
Sorry,
months? I think, yeah, 30, yeah.
Without breaks, so you went through a whole year cycle?
No, so we were there 3 months, 6 months, 4 months, 3 months, mostly between like 3 and 6 month blocks at a time, yeah. It took a long time to try to figure out what was going on. It was a lot harder to figure out what was going on here than it was to figure out what was going on my previous field site, where signaling was just, they were actually telling me it was signaling, and they told me about signaling theory, basically, because it's so explicit with Melanesian people. It's just right there.
That's one more question. When you were talking about how women are sort of conflicted, you know, do I go out with the person that I really should be generous to, or should I really go out on my own? And maybe you actually showed this data, so I apologize if you did, but is there a difference in terms of what, that good hunters are going to, in a sense, split their strategy? So one thing that we find with the foragers we work with is that they will, in a sense, pony up and do what they're supposed to do in terms of generosity and status and all of that most of the time. And then sometimes they'll just say, you know, I'm just going to go out with the good hunters because I need to feed my family tonight.
Yeah,
and so
they
have, I guess, that option that the not good hunters don't have. And they do.
Right. Well, they're still they're cooperating about 60 to 70% of the time on these hunts. So there's 30% of the time that people are not cooperating.
Does that fall out differently
for better hunters than for not better?
No,
hunters?
Like I said, that graph there is completely flat according to the according to rank.
And I don't understand how if the women are foraging principally for lizards. Are the men foraging or hunting principally for larger game? And then how does it come back and get distributed in the community, or does it not come back?
So the thing about this environment is it's extremely patchy. So basically you are limited to a single hunting activity per day. You can't really combine goanna hunting with kangaroo hunting or with anything else. So your foraging task group that gets developed is developed around a particular activity. When men come along, sometimes they'll drop the women off and then take the car and go up to a different patch completely and go kangaroo hunting or whatever. Sometimes, though, they will stay with the women and go goanna hunting. So they spend they do about 30% of their time as goanna hunting.
How much gets consumed on site? It felt to me like a lot was being consumed on site.
Almost all.
Almost all.
Yes.
And so how does the big haunch get back into the icebox?
If the men have gotten out and gotten something large, and there isn't a large group, because it still was going to get consumed at the camp, and they only bring back what hasn't been consumed at the camp back to the community. So there is no real like, oh, I'm going to save this and bring it back to my house at the community. No, the you have to share, and you have to give everyone share it out pretty evenly amongst that camp, and then only surplus can be taken back.
Kangaroo, and is there a hierarchy of foods? Are these lizards supposed to be equally delicious and equally nutritious?
Yeah, no, everybody likes lizard, everybody likes kangaroo. Lizard tends to be shared more with women and children. Men don't get to eat as much lizard as women do. Yeah, because there are fewer men that go out on these hunts, and then even when men are in the camp, I've got data for tomorrow's talk that shows this, even when men are in the camp, they're less likely to get lizard from a female hunter. The kangaroo, though, when kangaroo is acquired, it is shared to everyone. And I don't see any gender differences there. Like, if you were in a dinner camp, all the women present in the camp, and there's named portions. For kangaroo, every portion, it's 9 portions. Every portion has a name associated with it. Like, this is mother-in-law's leg, this is sister of the hunter's leg, and so on. They get that portion, and that's not their portion. It's theirs to distribute. And they'll give out pieces to the rest of their family.
And what about they don't look like they're, thin people, but I mean, what about their calorie and general nutritional status? And I'm just wondering if this would break down in situations where, food was scarce.
They're eating a lot of processed flour, and they've got a lot of diabetes too, that's the real problem because it's so cheap and the rest of the food in the store is so expensive. So pretty much all they rely on is the processed flour and then bush foods. With the way they talk about doing these dinner camps is we're going to go out and do it the old way because all these people grew up as foragers. I mean, most of these ladies here had their kids out in the bush. And so they say, we're going to do this the old way. There are people in the community, young people in the community, that say we're going to do it the new way. And the new way is very different from the old way. The new way is driving around the car with a gun hanging out the window looking for something to shoot all day. You don't ever go make a dinner camp, bring your food back, share it. So I get the sense that they're reenacting a lot of what they did in the past there at the dinner camps, which is very different from the new way of doing it.